And welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional news, state and hemispheric for that matter, affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week, we welcome back to the program Daniel Shore Roth from El Nuevo Herald. He's a columnist, frequently appears online and on television and on the radio. He is also Venezuelan-born, and will have a lot to say about the death of Hugo Chavez. Welcome back, Mr. Shore Roth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Steve Rothaus, a longtime member of the Miami Herald's writing staff, and is responsible for covering LGBT issues for the newspaper, as well as a whole bunch of other things. Steve Rothaus, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Phil.
We also expect to have Michael Grunwald with us from Time Magazine, as we'll discuss a whole range of issues. We are busy for this show, and we're also asking for your participation as well, and we'll do that along the way with the Public Insight Network, by phone, and by email. But we'll begin with what became the story of the week on Tuesday, the death felt around the world this week. The funeral is today for Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez, whose body will permanently lie in state. And here is how his death was announced on Venezuelan television on Tuesday afternoon.
Recibimos la información más dura y trágica que podamos transmitir a nuestro pueblo. A las 4:25 de la tarde de hoy, 5 de marzo, ha fallecido el comandante presidente Hugo Chávez Frías.
And that is how it sounded in Caracas when Venezuelans found out their president Hugo Chavez was dead. That last emotional voice, the vice president, his vice president, Nicolas Maduro. But a much different sound in the Miami-Dade city of Doral, home to this country's highest concentration of Venezuelan expatriates. So that is a taste of what it sounded like in Doral, and for that matter in Weston, also home to a very large concentration of Venezuelan Americans here. And Daniel Shore Roth, you grew up in Venezuela. Can you explain to us why these reactions were so different?
Well, as you could say, like, there's completely two opposites that have generated with the Chavez government. You have those who think Chavez is the Messiah. And that's why you see them. I mean, it's incredible to see them crying and just wailing with the, you know, there were millions of people taking his coffin. And then you see the other part of the country, which seems to be smaller because of the election results always, and that really feels that Chavez has left a trail of destruction in the country. So the fact that the person who created Chavismo, who created socialism for the 21st century, dies, even though his legacy remains and, you know, the Chavismo continues, the figure is out. So, and that's why you see people celebrating in Venezuela and outside, just that in Venezuela, people are keeping it quiet.
And the reason that many of the Venezuelans are here in South Florida is directly because of the Chavez government. The population of Venezuelans here has exponentially gone up in the last few years. You're not one of them because I think you came here before.
1 year before.
1 year before. But, you know, what can you explain to people who had to deal with that and live through that why there's so much happiness, and eventually, with these maybe hundred thousand people in the six figures, we don't even know how many Venezuelans, do you think now that they'll get a green light to go back?
Well, the surveys that have been done within this Venezuelan community show that most people wouldn't go back, even now that Chavez is gone. People have established their lives here. You know, it's they've got the new jobs, new professions. It's not so easy to return. The destruction in the country that has been left, it's not easy to cope with that. I would say people have come here for mainly political reasons. Venezuelans haven't been people of migration before this. We used to absorb a lot of immigrants in Venezuela. Most of these immigrants left to Spain, to Colombia, to South America. An issue is personal security. We have the highest index of murders in South America.
Highest in the world, right?
It's really, people will kill for an iPhone. You know, I was tweeting for the election saying, you know, everybody's in their phones while they wait on lines, and somebody tweeted back, well, thank God they can bring out their phones because we can't in public because you will get killed. So security reasons. There's also people who have been prosecuted politically, what you call the, you know, political refugees that come here. And some other people just don't see a future for Venezuela. And that's basically the basis of the community. Many people are middle class with professions. I think Venezuelan community has established themselves very well. You saw that article that ran about Venezuelan businesses. So we come well educated, a big chunk of the community.
Steve Rothaus, we may not be Venezuelan, but we know many of them, that we work alongside many of them. And it is part of our community that this is impacted.
Of course.
Large part of it.
And Daniel, I just wanted to ask you, perhaps you could talk about the relationship that Chavez had with Castro and how that evolved.
Well, from the beginning, it seemed that basically Chavez saw in Castro a father figure. And Castro helped him a lot ideologically, but also when there was like a coup and he was in prison for like 2 or 3 days in between his... Castro had a lot to do calling in and getting him out and getting the things. That relationship became, I mean, I don't know what psychologists will define it, but it was almost like a father-son. And as we know, Cuba has been leaving thanks to Venezuelan generosity. You know, Venezuela ships 96,000 barrels of oil a day. And in exchange, we get 35,000 Cubans who were working in Venezuela in poor neighborhoods as doctors, teachers. And that's one of the reasons the poor are so happy with Chavez, because they've seen access to healthcare, education, things that they didn't have before.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that later on. As we mentioned, a lot of tens of thousands, perhaps in the six figures, of Venezuelans here, the center of the community at in Doral, and they gather at this restaurant called El Arepazo Dos. Here is Cezuan Martinez, who was moved from Venezuela to Miami about 7 years ago.
We feel happy that, you know, this guy finally is gone. We all agree that Chavez was a cancer in not just my country. Chavez was a cancer for the whole Latin America and the whole world.
And we'll see elections for a new president within 30 days. We received many responses to the news of Chavez's death by email. Wes from Doral tells us Chavez will be remembered, quote, as a leader who tried to give the poor more but wasted an opportunity to use his oil funds to improve his country and all its people. Now, Daniel, I was trying to define what Chavez would be remembered for. Socialist hero, I came up with some words. Dilettante, dictator. I mean, why don't you continue? What will he be remembered for? You know better than
I would
most.
Say, like the Che Guevara of Venezuela, like that caudillo type that was loved by so many. And there's no doubt that Chavez is seen, and we see it now. Some people are calling him a semi-god. So some people will remember him as semi-god, and some others will remember him as the person who destroyed Venezuela's economy, Venezuelan social fabric, and Venezuela's democracy, because he's basically, there's no institutions anymore. There's not something in the United States you call check and balances. There's no check and balances. The Chavez regime owns not only the executive, but also the Congress, the judicial system.
The media,
and the electoral system also, the El Colegio Nacional Electoral. And I think that's one of the concerns about how authentic can elections be when that entity is governed by people who are Chavista.
And how about the embassy closing here in Miami? Is there a chance that that could be reopened now that Chavez has died? And we know of the tens of thousands of people that went to go vote in New Orleans last year.
Yeah, it's been really painful for the community because a lot of people depend on letters, whether it is to get money, retirement, school things, and people with children cannot travel back. So it's become a really hassle for Venezuelans in South Florida. There was an article today precisely in the Herald and El Nuevo about a like kind of a protest yesterday that they're going to try to pitch it to the United States that in their agenda of negotiations with the new government, they get to open the there's no doubt that this has been a painful for the Spanish, for the Venezuelan community, and it's been done like a punishment because of the lack of resources that now people have here. Imagine no passports, no cédulas. You have to travel to other consulates, and they're not prepared for the amount of Venezuelans that are here.
Perhaps the greatest irony of all this is that while the United States, Hugo Chavez, demonized the United States, much of the country's money came here to South Florida. And in fact, when the national real estate market went bust, the local market here was buoyed by condo purchases by Venezuelans. And in fact, Karen Burkett in our Friday Business Report mentioned that this morning on the radio, and will air again this afternoon, I think at 5:45. But it's amazing how it sort of didn't work out in that sense the way Hugo Chavez could ever have imagined it. And it's really bolstered his reign of over Venezuela, really ended up bolstering South Florida.
Well, some people think it's similar to the Cuban community, if you want to say it. Some people feel that, you know, Chavez wants out all these people that don't agree with him. And many of the people who don't agree with him are the people who have businesses, because he's been really terrible with the private sector. Although there is something called the Boli something, I forgot the name, which is the all these people that have a huge amount of wealth that have taken advantage of the Chavez regime. So these are people that some of them have houses here. And there was an article by Otto Reich, which is to be the ambassador of the U.S. in Venezuela, saying that the U.S. has to be more careful in screening because a lot of the Chavistas are buying homes here and are living lavishly. And much of this money has been made, you know, in questionable ways. There's a big relationship between the Chavez regime and drug trafficking and the FARC in Colombia. So we have to keep an eye of what, you know, where's the money coming from. But nonetheless, besides that small population of Chavistas that might be investing here, most Venezuelans here, I think, identify themselves as an opposition. And you've seen real estate businesses. Mm-hmm. It's really grown. People bring their money. They make the investments. Also, it's easier to get a visa in the United States if you have more than $100,000. So you create a certain amount of jobs and invest certain amount of money, and it's facilitated for people. Other people keep working in Venezuela and have their families here for security issues. So they have two homes here with the, you know, the family lives here and they go and come.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly been interesting. And I wanted to get some other comments from the Public Insight Network this week. In fact, we'll take a break and continue this. And if you have some comments, we'd love to hear from you. If you are here in South Florida and you came here because of Hugo Chavez, and we'd like to know if you were planning on going back, if things turn out the way that some hope here is a new government comes in, new elections are held, if that does happen. So ring us up if you're out there, 866, why don't I have the number in front of me? Boy, I really, really wish I should have the number. Here it is. It's 800-743-9576. You think I'd remember that by now? 800-743-WLRN. We'll take a break, come back, and move into some state issues as well. Steve Rothaus also will join us to talk more with Daniel Shore Roth. I'm Phil Latzman. The Florida Roundup continues in a moment. Stand by. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald, and Daniel Shore Roth from El Nuevo Herald on our panel this week. And we're going to open up the phones and get your thoughts from the Public Insight Network as well on the situation in Venezuela. And we got some other responses. Robert from Homestead says, how Chavez will be remembered depends on who you talk to. The poor will consider him a saint. The wealthy that bought all their money here will demonize him and say he was the devil. Jeff from West Palm Beach writes that Chavez will be remembered by thousands of low-income and elderly citizens, residents of Massachusetts, because I guess they had a heating oil deal, and other participating cold-weather states as generously providing heat oil at a below-market cost. And I think there's something else. And before we even get back, because we're going to take some calls, but Dan, you're Jewish. We heard many reports out of Venezuela about anti-Semitism. Whether he was an anti-Semite or not remains to be seen. I'm not sure, but the way he aligned himself with a lot of Arab countries that were certainly not pro-Israel, may that have something to do with this sentiment of anti-Semitism?
Yes, the main issue here is that anti-Semitism falls under the canopy of the hate that he injected between groups, whether it is minority groups, the wealthy, they call it oligarchies. He had a name for everyone. Now, the Jews are always an easy target in Latin America and other countries. Venezuela never was an anti-Semitic country as a whole. People were very welcoming. My grandparents came from the Holocaust. In fact, I'm writing a column for the weekend related to my experience as the son of immigrants or the grandson of immigrants. He took a anti-Semitic, more than it was his verbs, his discourse against Israel. He equated Israel to the Nazis. There was a raid once in the Jewish school. The community was very worried. A lot of people have left. A lot of people stay. It used to be a very stable community. We were a magnet of other Latin communities, Jewish communities that were struggling, Chile, Colombia, Peru, who came to Venezuela, Uruguay, Argentina. These people went back. And his alliance with all this Ahmadinejad and Libya and the check that was recently found of Iran, you know, with a PDVSA, an oil company check, I think it makes anyone afraid. But I would say anti-Semitism is within the destruction that he did of social fabric, putting some people against others.
All right, we're going to start to wrap up, but I did want to get to a couple of calls that have come in. Before we do that, though, the reaction from Washington has been optimism. Democrat Bill Nelson says he hopes the country will follow through with plans for new elections within 30 days and that much-needed reforms will also follow.
Hopefully, there will now be a peaceful transition of power in Venezuela with real, meaningful democratic reforms. And that means cutting back on all the limitations on freedom of speech and freedom of political activity with real economic reform and political participation.
Marco Rubio said it was his hope that Venezuela's leaders would, quote, seek to rebuild our once strong friendship. Now, what happens now is the elections, within 30 days, Maduro would still be considered the favorite against Capriles, who ran and lost against Chavez. But you talk about the Electoral Council and being that controlled by the Chavismos.
Yeah, there is five rectors that control the Electoral Council, and four are openly and, very loudly Chavistas. They say that there is a 2 million, that the voting list is inflated by 2 million voters, like phantom voters. So whenever an election starts, the Chavismo already has 2 million votes, And there's been different reports about how the electoral system is partialized. That makes it really hard to believe whether the elections are authentic. What I've heard is that the opposition needs to have such a wide range of numbers above Chavismo to win, because if it's a very short, a small number, it's not like here that 1% can define the election. So there is very many anomalies with the IDs, for example, quick nationalizations of people who are not Venezuelans, like Chinese. They brought Chinese voters. So there is a mistrust, and also the opposition has a lot to do, because they're supposed to be on every electoral school and college, and it wasn't present all around. So it really depends on how they can screen these elections.
Steve, you and I have been listening to this, or just kind of fascinated by the knowledge that Daniel has about this country, obviously having lived there. How do you think South Floridians, what do you think they've learned about Venezuela in the past years, weeks? What do you think?
I think that divided community. I mean, the fact that it's not black and white. That there is certainly a population that that continues to idolize this man. And, you know, just the talk about perhaps having change, political change in Venezuela, and I think that a signal yesterday that that will not happen certainly will be the announcement that was made that his body will be put on public display. Mm-hmm. This is not a government that is looking to make change.
Anastasios, calling us, are you actually in Venezuela, sir?
Yes.
Are you actually in country?
No.
Okay.
I'm from Europe.
Oh, okay. Well, where are you right now?
Right now I'm in Miami, Florida.
Oh, good. Okay. It said Venezuela, okay. But welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you. I'd like to, maybe I will never run for politician, but the truth is always the truth. I know Venezuela because I used to work for big companies when we extract the bauxite from Venezuela. And that time it was Perez. And Figueredo was the Minister of Economy. Now, Figueredo and Perez, they're a bunch of thieves, gangsters that stole billions of dollars.
These are the people in the Chavez, in the Chavismo?
No. I don't like Chavismo either, but at least he gave something to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't speak Spanish well, okay? But he gave something to them. He gave them free medicine. He gave them food. He gave them jobs. He was anti-American. I don't like that. He was a commie. I don't like that. I lost family in Europe when it was the civil war in north part of Greece from 45 to 50. Okay? So what I'm saying, we have to battle. This other gentleman there who says that somebody can steal your telephone for if they have an iPad and kill you. Well, it happened in the United States. It happened in France. It happened in Geneva. So let's not put all together. And if we give the 100 barrels a day oil in Cuba, that son of a bee there, Castro, but we had a 16,500 doctors supporting all the poor people for shots and everything else. So let's have a little balance and let's tell the truth.
All right. Thank you, Anastasios. I appreciate that. So let's cap off this discussion by saying, what did Hugo Chavez do right in his 14 years running Venezuela?
Well, I think that the speaker was very accurate in that. And what he did right was he brought into the masses some of these services that weren't available before. There's no doubt that there was a lot of corruption before he came to power. There were two parties and they were, you know, stealing a lot of money. But I don't think that what Chavez is leaving with him is any better. There's more corruption today. Inflation is 30%. So I think he leaves some people happy, a big chunk of the population, maybe with the, you know, more feeling more of a belonging to the country, whereas before when the white minority was kind of like white Venezuelan was in government, people felt they weren't represented.
All right, you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLR, and most of this first half hour has been spent with our friend Daniel Shore Roth from El Nuevo Herald, and as you've heard, of Venezuelan descent on the death of Hugo Chavez and what it means here in South Florida. Also with us, Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. I'm Phil Latzman. We're kind of going on the fly here, and Steve, we're going to be talking about more local issues, and I know that this weekend is big here in South Florida as far as the gay community is concerned. We'll talk about that as well in just a few minutes and why. We want to remind you that it's your show, too. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We're also emailable at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. We haven't mentioned that we do have a live tweet-a-thon going on with our social media editor. That's at WLRN, where you can participate in that. Each of these gentlemen do have Twitter addresses as well. You might as well give it out, Daniel, so you can spread your knowledge to our listeners.
At Daniel Shore Roth, and Shore Roth is Shoerroth.
And Rothaus, Steve, what's yours?
Steve Rothaus. It's Steverothaus, one word.
And I'm at Phil Latzman. And again, on our Facebook page, we have our WLRN Miami Herald News, actually our Florida Roundup Facebook page. We have all the shows listed on there and all different ways you can interact with us and our live blog being edited by Danny Rivero. Now, let's move on to some state issues because obviously it was the first week of session in Tallahassee. And if if Hugo Chavez had not died this week, we probably be talking a lot more about that. But that sort of overshadowed the news here in South Florida. So we're going to bring in with us our Tallahassee reporter, Gina Jordan, who is with us last week in studio. She has made her way back up the Florida Turnpike, I-75, whatever way she made it, to Tallahassee, and joins us there from the Capitol. Hi, Gina. Welcome back. Can you hear us?
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you back.
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. So let's start with the State of the State address this week. Governor Rick Scott kicked off the Florida Legislature's 2013 session by delivering the State of the State address. The theme of the speech was, "It's working," and the governor began talking about the accomplishments, as he saw it, of his first 2 years in office.
Over a period of time, they can have a legalized status that allows them to live a life of dignity, but not
No, it's the I'm sorry, Paul. We're switching things around. It's the State of the State, AK01. Little radio lingo there. It's the next. Okay. Well, we will just talk about it. We'll hear maybe just a little bit in a moment. But during the speech, just to paraphrase, the governor came back to two main objectives. One was a renewed focus and funding for education, teacher bonuses. The other one was to get rid of sales tax on manufacturing. Is that about what we heard on Tuesday, Gina?
That is what we heard, and as a matter of fact, he really spent a lot of time on the theme of it is working. He spent a lot of time showing, look, in my administration, unemployment is down. We have a budget surplus. We've got performance pay in place for teachers. So, yeah, he talked a lot about the things that he thinks are working thanks to his administration.
All right. And it did seem like, Gina, a much more seasoned and relaxed governor than the nervous guy that we saw in the past. Is he more confident despite his approval rating still being very low right now?
I think he is. I think he knows that if he wants to be reelected, he's going to have to do some compromising. And so he's actually made some of his usual opponents happy by proposing.
All right. Well, Gina's line is
$2,500. A teacher raise by talking about this turnaround for Medicaid.
Right, yeah. Well, we're having a little difficulty through Skype, which is always fun for live radio, but we'll hope that improves. But what drew the biggest applause from the State of the State was the governor's controversial decision to expand Medicaid, even if it means accepting the Affordable Care Act and its federal funds for the first 3 years.
As I wrestled with this decision, I thought about my mom and her struggles to get my little brother health care with no money. I concluded that for the 3 years, the federal government is committed to paying 100% of the cost of new people in Medicaid. I cannot, in good conscience, deny the uninsured access to care.
And you can hear the reaction there in the Senate chamber, or the House chamber, rather, the state Senate. Both the governor, both appear in favor of expanding Medicaid. They've made it clear. The House, though, not so much. They actually took a vote on that this week. So what's the latest with Medicaid expansion, Gina?
So the latest is that this issue is dead in the House. The Senate may try to come up with something that House Speaker Will Weatherford can agree with, but for now, it looks like it doesn't have a good shot. If the Senate comes up with something, the House may take it up again. But from the governor's perspective, he can at least say, hey, this was my proposal. I wanted this.
And so Medicaid expansion is not going to pass the House as far as you see it. So basically, they will not create these exchanges and these things we've talked about. And these million plus people will not be able to get on Medicaid, or will some compromise be reached, do you think?
It's still possible that there will be a compromise, but the Senate will have to come up with that, because a House committee has already made the decision that the House will not craft a bill to expand Medicaid. So if the Senate comes up with an option that Speaker Weatherford can get in on, then it is still possible that it could happen.
Also, in this first legislative week, the state Senate wasted no time, as promised, in unanimously passing the Ethics Reform Bill. What is in that?
There are a few things. The main thing, the Senate plan would make it tougher for lawmakers to just jump right into lobbying as soon as they leave office. More information about their finances would have to be posted online. The Ethics Commission would get more power to actually launch investigations. and to collect fines from lawmakers who have some violations. Plus, it also would keep lawmakers from getting job promotions or being given a cushy job on the side just because of their position, which is sort of what happened with House Speaker Ray Sansom when he took that part-time job with the university. So next week, a House panel is going to take up its own ethics bill. And for now, the two chambers are still somewhat apart as far as how to cap campaign donations, that sort of thing. So they have a little bit to work on there.
As far as elections are concerned, that's another thing that seems to be getting done this week, is that the election reform, and everybody agrees it needs to be done. The state House passed a resolution this week, or passed a bill, the preliminary part of the bill, acknowledging that lawmakers, here's House Speaker Will Weatherford, to acknowledge that lawmakers do share the blame for the election fiasco.
I think the legislature has some responsibility for some of the challenges we had in 2012. I readily admit that, and that's why we passed it on the first day. We were not going to let any grass grow under our feet. This is a bill and an issue that needed to be addressed early, and we've done so today.
So that bill passed easily, so they seem to agree that there's something needs to be done immediately about elections, but that, the blame needs to be spread around a little bit.
Yeah, this was the Republicans' chance to say, look, we agree something has to be done, and so that bill actually passed 118-1 in the House. One Republican voted against it, and Speaker Weatherford was actually disappointed that they didn't get a zero there on the second part of that line.
Steve Rothaus, I'm curious to know, obviously that story about the voting, it resonated a lot here with the problems that we had. Do you think that's going to be enough for a lot of people here in South Florida, that they do this?
Well, I mean, I'd like to get back to that for just a minute, but Phil, I wanted to ask Gina on the Medicaid issue and Speaker Weatherford. There's a story today that his family actually had used the Medicaid system for his younger brother, which at first he said it hadn't. Do you think that his position has been weakened at all on this issue as a result of the public now knowing that he himself was a beneficiary of Medicaid?
Well, here's what he says about it.
Well, unfortunately, I think that we're going to not take any more.
You
know what? Let's take a break and see if we can establish that connection a little bit better. And there's also a couple other things as far as education and the texting while driving bill that we have not had a chance to discuss. Things are kind of all over the place today, but that's the kind of day it's been, the kind of week it's been here in Florida. We'll take a break. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. Gina Jordan, Phil Latzman, Daniel Shore Roth, and Steve Rothaus. More local stuff as well when we continue in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. And our guests in the studio, Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald, Daniel Shore Roth from El Nuevo Herald, and Gina Jordan. Hopefully, let's see if our Skype line has improved from Tallahassee on week one of the session. It's always iffy with the live radio. Gina, can you hear us okay? Can we hear you okay, I guess, is the best question.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we'll take our chances with that. Thank you. And now, well, one other thing we wanted to mention, a couple other things actually before we let you go. The texting while driving bill, the sponsor of that bill that would ban texting while driving, says thinks it will pass this year. Senator Nancy Dietert, the bill passed its second Senate committee on Wednesday, and she says House Speaker Will Weatherford, unlike past Speaker Dean Cannon, will actually now give it a hearing.
We have a really good chance this year. The speaker last year did not like the bill and would not let it be heard in one committee. This year's speaker, I think, will at least allow his chamber to speak.
So might texting while driving, this ban, pass this year, and what would it do, this bill?
It has a shot. It is moving through the Senate with some concessions. Like drivers could text at a red light, for example. That's one concession that was made. But the House version is a little stricter. And the one thing that both of these versions have in common is that it's a secondary offense. So if someone is texting while driving, they would have to be doing something else to get a ticket. So for those reasons, it may have a better shot this year.
And that's something we had the seatbelt law here for a very long time that was a secondary offense and people didn't wear their seatbelts. And when they became a primary offense, people started wearing their seatbelts. But anyway, now the last thing I wanted to mention with you, and Daniel Shore Roth this week wrote a great column about the parent trigger bill for the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald as well. This parent trigger bill just passed yesterday. It's one of the most controversial things in the session. The House Choice and Innovation Committee has passed it. Why is this parent trigger bill, when it comes to education and charter schools, so controversial?
Well, some would say that this is very much about taking taxpayer money and handing it to for-profit corporations who would run charter schools. Now, Patricia Levesque spoke to the committee yesterday. She is director of an education think tank that was founded by former Governor Jeb Bush. She said this is a parent empowerment bill. Why not give the parents an option of having a say and turning around a failing school? And she added that this is not a charter school bill, even though opponents keep wanting you to think that it is.
And Daniel, you wrote a great column about this week. Put a lot of thought into it. What did you say?
And it was very timely. I
mean, yes, you hit right on.
Yeah, well, the bill has different choices, and besides the turnaround to charter school, there is also converting the school to district-managed turnaround school, move students to another school and monitor the progress of each student, etc. But there is an effort, and the State Board of Education has been very open about increasing charter schools in Florida, so that's why it's leaning towards that that line. The problem with this bill is that it gives parents a first voice. It's not really empowering. You empower parents when you train them to be more active in the school community. So the parents can make a decision. 51% of the parents, let's say, not all the parents. So these confront parents against parents. But what happened with the other 49% of parents that might not agree with a conversion? In Miami, last week, we saw in Key Biscayne, parents rejected an attempt to convert the school, Key Biscayne K-8, but what's important to say is that the state already permits, and the federal laws, as I said in my column, permits conversion of schools to charters, and they can do that with the input of administration and teachers. This bill is only with 51% of the parents. And the act does not include a mechanism for a reverse trigger. That means it does not set forth a procedure for unconversion or reconversion of a charter back to a traditional schools. And the thing here that's most important is that we are trying to rush to the creation of charter schools. There are really good charter schools, and they do offer a very innovative education process. But for some reason, it hasn't yet been completely established of the success. And one of the most easy way to see it is that one out of four charter schools close in Florida. Mm-hmm. Nationally, it's one out of eight. And many of the problems they've had is financial, because there's no enough oversight, and also academic. So instead of rushing to create more charters, I think the focus should be more on strengthening the charters that we already have. And it's very important what she mentioned about transferring money to for-profit corporations, because while we're doing that, we're subtracting money from the traditional school system. Now, the school system, Miami-Dade school system, has to welcome everyone
right.
who comes in, as I said in my column.
And accommodate them.
And accommodate them at any day of the year. And charter schools do have a screening, and it tends to be, you know, sometimes it leads towards segregation.
Right. And the issue of charter schools not going away, and certainly will be discussed a lot more in Tallahassee and beyond. Hey, Gina, thanks so much for doing this. We'll try to check up with you on a regular basis, and we'll get the latest from Tallahassee. Thank you, Gina Jordan.
Thank you, Phil.
All right. Steve Rothaus, that leads us to another thing that may or may not be talked about. In fact, let's get to a call first, because our producer is saying that we've got something good here. Barry from Plantation wants to talk about the trigger bill. Barry, yeah. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Hi.
All right, thanks. First of all, my comment is don't confuse Tallahassee with the facts. They have an agenda to privatize public education, whether it's the trigger bill, the charter schools. No matter how you dice it and splice it, you're comparing apples with oranges, and they don't want to know the facts. The facts, regardless of this think tank that's funded by Jeb Bush, who was the first one to privatize public education, Stanford University did a study many years ago, and they had no axe to grind. The charter schools do not have any better outcomes than public schools, and they cherry-pick their students. They don't take people with disabilities, behavior problems are thrown out. So you're not comparing apples with oranges.
Right, and the Miami Herald had a fantastic investigation along with WLRN last year on the charter schools and who they couldn't and could not accommodate, and the fact that they're not very racially mixed. You know, there's not a lot of minorities. But anyway, I think that point has been made. Barry, thanks very much for getting in the conversation. I appreciate
all
that.
Right.
Now, I did
want
to get to this with Steve. Boy, you've been patient listening to all of this. The other issue that may or may not be discussed is the domestic partnerships, gay marriage.
Right.
What's the latest on that statewide?
Well, on Tuesday in Tallahassee, Senator Eleanor Sobel of Broward, her committee will be having another discussion on a domestic partner registry for the state of Florida. Now, 18 jurisdictions within the state already have enacted domestic partner registries, and that includes Miami Beach, Miami-Dade County, Palm Beach, Broward County. But what Senator Sobel is looking to do is to create a statewide registry, which you know, has failed five times that she's tried to bring this up. But this year she happens to be chairman of the committee.
Mm-hmm.
So she's able to bring it up. But it kind of died on the first discussion a few weeks ago. And she's going to bring it up again with some changes. We don't know exactly what the changes will be. But essentially, it would allow people to register with the state as domestic partners. And, you know, one of the issues there is the fact that in 2008, the state embedded in its constitution that it wouldn't recognize marriage between same-sex partners. So there's some discussion as to whether a registry like that would conflict with the constitutional amendment. But then
that's a question there, too, though, because 2008, the same year that President Obama was elected, people of the state of Florida, and I don't remember the number, but overwhelmingly approved that. Now we've seen other states have approved it since, or have gone along with the allowing gay marriage. Do you think that things are different now, 4 years later? Do the results be different?
Well, I think that the polling shows that things are very different. But, I mean, it wasn't an overwhelming vote. It was by about 2%.
It was only 2%.
It was 2% that in which it passed. But, I mean, you know, this is so interesting because at the same time, the U.S. Supreme Court is actually going to be ruling on two very important marriage issues, one being Proposition 8 in California and whether or not gay marriages there will resume. And then the other would be the Windsor case, which is a federal case involving the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and Section 3 of that, in which the federal government is not allowed to recognize marriages performed legally in states like New York or in other countries. So, I mean, where Florida is not even at the point of doing catch-up, the U.S. government is moving ahead, and the Supreme Court may very well make major changes this June.
Very interesting, and something to follow. You're listening, we should remind you, to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. If I haven't said that, I'm Phil Latzman. Good afternoon, good morning, if you're listening on Saturdays. Our guests in the studio today, Daniel Shore Roth from El Nuevo Herald and Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. We are continuing to take some of your feedback as well. But this is moving on, making a severe turn here to a story that I think is all everybody has an opinion on. Just it's kind of scary when you think about it. The fact that we have sinkholes in the state of Florida. Now, none of us on this panel are geologists or will pretend to be one, but we've all read about what happened to this poor man in Sefner near Tampa last week, where he just fell through his bedroom floor to his death 100 feet below as a sinkhole formed. A Florida geologist says we can expect more of these in the state in the coming years. Sinkholes are formed when rocks below the surface erode, creating a cavity. While they can form anywhere in Florida, they most often occur in the central and the southwest parts of the state. So we don't have as much of a risk here in southeast Florida. And state geologist Jonathan Arthur says as the state's population increases and there's more construction, sinkholes will likely form more often in populated areas.
The land disturbances can trigger sinkholes. Certain conditions related to pumping and the lowering of the water table can trigger sinkholes as well. So, you know, the odds are such that we're more likely going to hear about an increase. That said, sinkholes are going to form even if we weren't around.
Arthur says sinkholes occur in several other states besides Florida, but the large amount of limestone in the state makes Florida's geology perfect for them to form. This is no laughing matter at all in any way, But the thought of thinking about that you could be on this bed of limestone that could collapse at any time, it just brings you back to nature controls us all. But I don't think we knew it until this hit home with this guy in Tampa, this gentleman in Tampa who died, that this was such an issue.
Well, I mean, not just that, but I mean, just how outrageous the situation can be. I mean, 110 stories. This man fell from his bed 10 stories into the ground, and his body will never be found. It's just unfathomable.
Another thing is that the citizens people are saying that these sinkholes are causing their policies to be changed, and that's ending up costing everybody around the state because of this threat of sinkholes. So it's having an impact, whether you believe that or not. It's having an impact on, it might have an impact on your pocketbook.
Well, I mean, nature here in Florida, you know, had never took into account the development throughout the state, and you know why we don't have sinkholes in this part of the state, because the composition is so different. But we're just floating on marsh. We're floating on, so it's a different composition completely.
Right, the limestone's thicker. It's younger, apparently, in the southeast Florida. But the fact that there's a saltwater intrusion underneath aquifer distribution of the water, that could cause things to speed up a little bit. So there's that. Anyway, we want to cap some things off. Daniel, we did talk about the fact that we started the show. We spent the first half hour talking about the death of Hugo Chavez this week, and you eloquently described all the things that have happened there and have happened here. So many now are re-examining this relationship between Cuba and Venezuela. Many describe Fidel Castro, as you talked about and even said before, father and son. Others say he was Castro's greatest admirer. Andy Gomez is with the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami. He says the death of Hugo Chavez is in some ways the breaking of a lineage.
Chavez was the person unpicked or unselected by Fidel, but the heir apparent to the left, the anti-Yankee imperialist movement. I don't think now, with Chavez out of the picture, that there is that person.
So, Dr. Gomez, there's no question that Raul is now the highest profile leftist leader in Latin America, but no indicators that he's going to want to create a dialogue with the U.S., and no indication, as we said before, that Venezuela will do that. So how do these two things go together?
Well, I think, I don't know if you noticed, but there was a picture today. Raul Castro went to Venezuela, and he was sitting there next to Maduro. The Maduro government is very aligned with Havana, so the Maduro government, the Maduro philosophy, there's two branches within Chavismo. You have one that's with Maduro, and they're very loyal to Havana, and then you have the Diosdado Cabello of the General Assembly. They're more nationalistic, and if they get a hold of the government, there'll be a cut with Cuba. That will be most likely.
We'll stay tuned on that. So what are some of the stories you're going to be working on? I know you're working on the 500th anniversary of Ponce de León's arrival.
On the 27th of March, 500 years ago, exactly, someone called Juan Ponce de León some land. He thought it was Bimini, but it was Florida, and he called it Florida because it was, you know, Easter Sunday. I'm working on a interesting story about a seal that was found in Amelia Island. They were building a house, the Dorian family, and they found the seal. It was the place where there was a Spanish mission, Santa Catalina de Iguale. So I'm working about how the seal was uncovered, what it means to the history of Florida and archaeology. And the pieces are a History of Miami Museum, so it's great. It ties into Miami.
Well, we look forward to that. Steve Rothaus, Winterfest this weekend.
We have Winter Party in Miami-Dade County. We have Pride Fest in Fort Lauderdale. So this weekend, huge numbers of LGBT visitors, both in Miami-Dade County and in Fort Lauderdale, will be covering those events throughout the weekend.
And you can read all about it at Steve's blog. It's miamiherald.com/gay. Daniel Shore Roth, from El Nuevo Herald, you heard about what he's writing. Great to have you here.
Well, anybody can have access to my columns at miamiherald.com and elnuevoherald.com. They're bilingual.
And so you should read them. Yeah, bilingual columnist. It's a unique thing, and we appreciate that, Dan and Steve Rothaus. Thank you so much for being here. Does it for the Florida Roundup, Friday, March 8th, 2013. We made it through. if you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow. Darn good show, too. Tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., we'll also post it on our website, WLRN.org. Florida Roundup, produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Elaine Chen, our associate producer, our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow. Social media editor is Danny Rivera. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, Stan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat next. Until next week, I'm South Florida. Stay informed, South Florida. Thanks for listening.